about John W. Statsis, because I've got my own. Edward told me since there's a resident pair of glasses here. Ego. When she doesn't want to make love, he says, what's wrong? As if something must be. She says, there's nothing wrong. He says, but there must be something wrong. The master needing reasoning. She feels she should have a note from her mother. Dear sir, would you please excuse my daughter from sex? The time of the month is not right. She's worried about the telephone bill. An earthquake rocked Tokyo tonight. She's afraid of waking the baby. Halley's Comet won't pass again for 67 years. She's afraid of making a baby. And the Dow Jones Index showed an unfavorable low at close of business. And you probably did it last night. Two nights ago at the most. He nudges her with his elbow. Go on. You can tell me what's wrong. Was it something I did? Something I said? But there's nothing wrong. I keep telling you. This lady, she heaves towards the wall, taking his questions and most of the blankets. Freezing on the edge of the world, she knows that nothing is wrong. For tonight, she has learned three things about ego, the tug of the moon, why women invented the headache. You're often in a more benevolent mood than that. Angel. He said, I am old and everything has a bitter taint. And besides, I have only these oddments to offer. Things broken, unfinished, unused. And I'm not even sure why it is that I've kept these so long. But she saw how his body radiated light and how he carried not just the jumble of wheels, coils, springs, but the very ones she'd been needing to mend, the faltering mechanism of her heart. And his eyes were pure as a child's, and from that moment on, she was his entirely. I have a great fondness for fairy tales and stuff. You know, I think the imagination has to go back to how we first done. And this is called Dreaming Snow White. If, while journeying through darkened woods, you stepped into a clearing and found me stretched there dead, with all my hair spread out, my body white as camphor, would you raise the lid that held me? Would you kiss me on the mouth? Would your velvet tongue dislodge the bite of poisoned apples from my throat? And would there be a white horse, his golden bridle gleaming, his breath like surging water, impatient to spirit up the way to some happy ever after? I'm a great woman for making this. So far I'm sticking to it, but I departed in the without any provocation really. Sometimes I throw stuff at you, you know, and you can't do a whole lot about it. And my reaction is often just the right one. Which sometimes is a pretty useless thing to do, but this is called Waking. It was written when my son was 70. Yes. He was around 17 at the time. Anyhow, waking. I tiptoed the width of the landing to check that my eldest child, the curtains hanging open, the room half bright with streetlight. He is broad, like any teenager, suddenly too broad for his narrow bed. His eyes in shadow, his jawline shadowed like a man. I go no further than the door, for here in this dim room sleeps a breach too deep for a mother's teething kiss. Yet he smiles when he sleeps, tossing ball on the green with his two dead friends. Until that Sunday morning, when it all came crashing in, death with a too big dumper stored on the highest shelf. I have watched him tentatively easing it on, daily growing into it. I do a lot of getting out in poems as well. This isn't really getting out, like I said, no, it is, but anyway, it's a bit nasty in that. Knowledge. We should all acquire a bit of that every day if we can. Anyway, knowledge. Having gazed too long, I learned the dogs exact their vengeance still. Snakes in my hair, these pig's teeth, insensible flesh. Don't come here with your bright shield. I will not crumble in the face of that a second time. There is nothing here for you to kill or love. Nothing flows here. Nothing grows in my stone garden. Only these grotesque gnomes. Too late they move their eyes to shield their eyes from the sight of me. One deathly glance, another stupid hero stands before me, petrified. Like in Irish mythology, you know, I can't think of the proper word for it, there's a big sense of word for it, I can't think of it, it's like shape-shifting. So things change form. And so this is called, it's the title poem from this, Sounds of Midnight Talk. I will come to you in a cloak of darkness on a sultry night to warm for sleep. Watch for the cloud of my breath on your window, for the whimper of nails on the glass. I will lead you past the boundary of the garden on a zigzag path through moonlit fields. I will guide you to a secret place I know of, where a warm stream feeds a shaded pool. And as you shake the moisture from your body, I will land you safely back inside your head. And when you wake without me, don't dismiss me as some creature the darkness made you dream. I am real as anything you care to touch. Step outside, my love. Inhale the morning. You will catch my lingering scent on the air. I don't know if any of you have ever done the tourist trail in Clonmany, but they're famous for our 3 lakes, and they're absolutely wonderful and beautiful. But I don't like boats at all. I don't like water. Boats are fine if they're on dry land. And I was lucky enough, the Kerry County Council did this initiative a few years ago, which is brilliant, and other county councils should copy them, where they invited all the actors from all different disciplines on a 2-day tour. And they decided they were doing islands. So the first year they went to Valencia, and another year they went to Skye Lake, and they went to all sorts of exciting places. So anyway, I was wondering, you know, are they going to ask me? So they did. And Kate Kennedy, the arts officer, said, you know, and guess where we're going? We're going to Inishallan. Now Inishallan is a little island in the middle of one of the Clonmany lakes, and it's about 200 yards from my house. And I thought, gee, this is great. I have to go on the boat, but like, this close to home. But anyway, the result of all that was, all the actors, we all had to produce two pieces. So I had to do two poems, and there was photographers and sculptors and all that sort of thing, and an exhibition was mounted in, and it all toured the Comedy Libraries for the winter. I thought it was a fantastic thing. So anyway, this is setting out. This is about the boat. Setting out. The unsteady sway of the boat as it moved across grey water had me gripping with both hands to the wooden seat. I watched the castle growing smaller until it was only a dark smudge, receding into a widening view of water, shoreline, trees. and the fear left me on that stretch of open page, as a light breeze drew back my hair, and the spray's touch was gentle as your fingers tracing the contours of my face. The boatman joked that he had drowned no one so far that morning. I thought his bones, embraced by water, caressed by weeds, of swimmers who never made it home. Below me, I saw a woman looking up from another world. I knew there were urgent stories she had come to tell, and I was all attention, her face flashing past the boat in a continuous reel as we neared the island. I smiled down at her. In the shallow, she disappeared. With the engine cut, there was only the idle slabber of water against the boat, the knock, knock of wood on stone. I stepped out onto the pier like that first time, stepping into your arms, safer than anything I had known. I have a great fondness for cats. I'm a cat person, so if you don't like cats, this poem is not for you. I just love their bad little nasty self-signature reading. Just heavy. Just to love him, for he is all that the predator about him. Disdained scraps, trapped sunlight in the nap of his fur, weaves his centrails through other gardens, unsheathed sharp claws, winds three times round the circle of himself, is merciless. Yet graces my nose with one swift kiss, arches his body to my touch, curls in my lap, laps milk from the bowl, croons his guttural songs for me, reflects the glow of the moon in his eyes. Incises the moth with a snap of his jaws, draws darkness around him, soundlessly vanishes, all nine lives intact. John Douglas, that stopped working there for a second. You should warn me about that. That just went blank, sir. Yeah, it was me. It's about time I get over for some feeding. Let's stop working, because I think they're faulty. You should really have them. What's wrong with me? I have this great relationship to my sister. Well, one of my sisters. That's truth in life, because it's true about one of them, it's true about the other one. But in different ways. I find the case of intimacy. This happened, we were at a wedding, family wedding, and I was wearing a long black skirt, and I thought I didn't have this adopting going on anymore. Anyway, she made a comment that wasn't very nice. So I wrote home. Eagle eye. She looked at me and thought she saw a witch, a bitch, a twister. I held her gaze, she thought she saw a spell, a well, a power. I raised my arm, she thought she saw a wand, a threat, a danger. But then, on her own skin, an itch, a rash, a blister. And when she looked at me again, she saw herself, my sister. This poem, I'm going to finish from this book with this poem. My new book is dedicated to my daughter. And this is quite an old poem I'm going to read. This was written when she was 3. She's now 16. And any of you who have daughters of 3 or 16, they're a lot nicer than they're 3 years old. So write a poem about them now, so that you can read it when they're 16 and you can remind yourself why you like them. I didn't think you might like them. She was lovely, isn't she? Anyway, my daughter gathered me. She's been lovely. She's not here, so I can say all these things, but my daughter gathered leaves. You ran in the back door past washer and dryer, the battered old dresser, your father's black boots, your little feet racing, your voice all excited to show me the treasures you've cleaned in your play outside in the crisp autumn grass. Your arms overspilling with leaves you had gathered, your pockets poured more in a stream on the tiles. Your wellies were brimming with fistfuls you stuffed there, your hair was embroidered red, amber, and gold. Look at me, I'm a tree. I'm a tree and I'm dancing. Look at me, I'm a tree. I'm a tree in the wind. I looked and my kitchen was spinning as a frenzy of color flew out from your limbs. I picked up your rhythm, your color, your vision, could have spun there forever with you in my arms, little tree. Ladies, you know, when you're sitting in a very normal situation, having a cup of tea or having a cup of coffee or something like that, and suddenly he says something like incredibly stupid. And he has no clue he said this, like, would you have, and like the atmosphere changes. And look at his, it does. And look at his face changes, but he still has a very sure what's going on. This is about that kind of situation. It's called the trigger factor. Just one word casually dropped, and suddenly I'm bristling, all the old hurt bubbling up and threatening to spill the length of the table where you sit beside me, not having a clue as to my black switch of temperament. The cat is perched on the shelf, eyes locked on the goldfish as it does its rounds. I open the fridge, and the last of the milk is curdled and yellowing, and there's a whiff of something gone rotten from way back far behind the cheese. You are still talking, but of course I've lost all thread of what about. My heart is protesting. How could you have, when our love was so new and all? I bang the door of the fridge. The cat, being worried, scampers off. The goldfish continues its circle, oblivious. And you are still talking as I bring to the table tea and sour milk and cheese that's quite possibly tainted. I covered my unreadable silences, a covered dish containing my issues as yet unresolved. Lastly, I plank down a plate which holds my recalcitrant heart, pulsing and steaming, completely given over to this love, careful of it. Another giving out one, but it's very short. I got over this one very quick. Can you find it? It falls from the pool of the garden, she speaks. This is me in a bed night. Did you think, little man, I would fatten on the pickings you chose? Did you think I would thrive on the slivers you sliced from your life? Did you think I'd survive a woman like me, a woman of appetite? My mother suffered from Alzheimer's disease for actually nearly 14 years, and it's weird to think of it. You forget stuff, but in my mother's case, because she was a stubborn little woman in her day, she made up stuff to fill the gaps, you know, and I think it's a pretty common thing. And she was convinced she had a brain tumor, and you tell her she had Alzheimer's, and she'd forget that. But she always remembered this lie that she made up, which is that she had a brain tumor. And she did the same exact story over and over. And of course, eventually you were agreeing with her and telling her she had a brain tumor. And after a few weeks of it, really, you didn't know what anyone had, or whether you had it. So everything is very surreal, real. So this is called living in the surreal with Eloise. My mother knocks on the side of her head, still active inside her, still vital, her need to blame, her need to name, to explain away the confusion she wakes to. My mother makes a tight, knotted knot of her hand, knocks on the side of her head. It's in there, she says, the tumor, red and hard and the size of my fist. It makes me forget. They told me it's there, deep in my brain like the yolk in an egg. They can't get it out without killing me. Do you think they will kill me? It makes me forget. Why can't I forget that it's there? Why can't I forget to forget? She knocks on the side of her head as if someone might answer, as if someone might open the door to her brain. She knocks, but nobody's home. She's even forgotten my name. I am visitor. I am the one she complains to. I am the one who is helpless as her. She knocks on the side of her head. I imagine the lump she imagines inside of her head. I imagine it shrinking. She knocks on the side of her head and it falls out her ear, rolls like a marble. Look, I tell her, it's gone. It fell out your ear, rolled under the table, got hit by the cat. She laughs. Was it grey? No, I say, it was black. Black as the darkness, black as the devil. A right bad lot, but he swallowed it up, then he swallowed a rat. And she laughed. I remember, she said, it was black, black as the darkness, but he swallowed it up, and she sleeps. I untangle her fingers, smooth out her hand, and she sleeps, and I drive home through the rain, through the nighttime, and the hedgerow disgorges a cat that stands in the glare of the headlights. And I stopped to salute it, to grant it safe passage home. The dying, well, for my mother's case, was a very long and harrowing business. Dying is terrible. But actually, death itself can become in a very sham thing. So, on the morning of my mother's passing, on that morning, grey crows gathered on the bushes surrounding her house, and my father not there to clap his hands loudly and scatter them. On that morning, jackdaws encroached on my windowsill, jabbing for bread, and I too busy with breakfast to push them away. On that morning, summoned too late to her bedside, I saw a blue-black crow rise up from her shoulder, three silver hairs from her head in a tense beak. Remembering other stuff, good stuff. I said before, you know, when you were raised a good Irish Catholic girl of my generation, which I'm not sure what this is, sex was always a problem, you know, you have to try and figure it all out as you go along. And if you lived in the village where I lived in, they taught you nothing, you know, absolutely nothing. And when you asked, they told you lies instead, you know, so we grew up thinking all sorts of stuff. We had to figure stuff out for ourselves. Anyway, this is all drastic. There was no sex in our village. There was only cabbage. Row upon row of it, spinning the heather on high straight ridges. That's where babies came from, we were told, in all seriousness. My sister still remembers being shown the exact head that she was discovered under. We knew everything about growing the small, limp plants that needed constant watering, learned how to protect them from root flies and caterpillar infestation, recognized the different varieties from January King to Curly Kale, sown in sequence for year-round cropping. instructed that it was never harvested until their hearts were firm, and babies were something only grown-up women found. Of sex, we knew nothing. We all hated it, the damp smell of it cooking that lingered through the whole house for hours after it was eaten, the sloppy look of it on the plate, the runoff staining the spuds and bacon. But it was good for us, so we were made to finish it. Remember how mother would add a teaspoon of soda to the water to soften the fibers. Years later I learned that this destroys the flavor, disarms the vitamins. The mix was easy to believe in a farming community until our hormones and neighbor sons, who were well versed in animal husbandry, illuminated the shortcomings in our education. Oh, my sisters, we are the daughters of cabbages and should celebrate our cruciferia lineage, tough and sinewy, of a strong variety, adaptable to any climate, winter hardy, never one to take ourselves too seriously. When I think of it, my sisters, all that green we swallowed. I've got a sister who lives in Australia. That's a nice one. I'm at the wrong page, but anyway, I'll keep talking. And my father's been dead for years, actually. He's been dead 13 years now. But that doesn't stop him, and really, they're both so far away from me in one way that they're both not far away at all. It's like an equal distance. So anyway, she rang me one day, and she was describing there was this awful drought for her. She was in Canberra, and it was the worst drought I'd had in years. And this night, I had this dream. So this is based on a dream I had. And so I read these bars. In your sister's dream, your father is cutting turf in Weedy's bog, testing the glistening loaves of peat to dry in rows along the bank. Never mind that your sister's bed is stretched across the parched red earth of Canberra. Where your father walks, the ground is spongy soft. Dark water trickles in to fill his footprints. Your sister has picked an armful of canavan and is leaning over the edge of the bank to see herself reflected in the flooded trench. Never mind that your father is 12 years dead, for he takes her hands and draws her back from the treachery of the still black water, and she wakes in a time of drought, the princess of wetlands of heather. This one, I actually haven't read this before, except myself and the cat around the kitchen. I don't know. It's inspired a bit. I was thinking about the secret of Smith, you know, where he's, oh, I don't know, the gods do the dirty of him as they usually do, and she's sent him to climb the mountain forever with a stone, and he's back or rolls up the mountain or whatever. So it's kind of the womanly version of that, anyway. I don't know, really. Anyway, all about climbing. After he slaughtered her, he dumped her body in the market square, where merchants and citizens continued their trading, averting their eyes from the sight of her broken corpse, the limbs fused at grotesque angles. A fly alighted on her eyelid, its blue-green body gleaming like a jewel. A mouse nibbled flour from under a fingernail. A goat strayed from its pen, sniffed at her body, lay down beside her. Her house cat navigated the alleyways of the rural town till he found her, a rat curled asleep in her armpit. Then the last slice of moon slid down from the sky, lodged in the small of her back. From high in the hayloft, an owl let out its long note across the dark. And that was the song she heard as she woke, the sound that led her to walk to the foot of the mountain. Now she carries the moon on her back and she climbs. Her days are all about climbing, all about purpose, committed to restore the moon to the sky, hangeth aloft. So she climbs in her blood-red shoes, her tattered garments. There is no slipping back. There's one thing great in well, there's more than one thing, isn't there? There's one great thing about having a teenage daughter. Sometimes there's clouds with you. You know, the blue. There's that look between you across the kitchen and you know, God, she's nearly there now. I sound very empty, man, I'm not even. But anyway, this is kind of one of those times in the night. Got a lady in white. Out of contrariness, out of blackguarding, out of the need for a small rebellion, myself and my daughter built a snow woman. Outside of the house, out of clumped snow, we fashioned her. A sexy dame with a jaunty hat, big bellied and laughing. Then we were laughing too, and pleased to meet her. And she, not at all surprised that we conjured her to appear for one night only, in our small town garden. Meanwhile, word had spread, and women from the neighborhood were gathering, leading small girls by the hand. The child from up the street squirmed through the laughter to present her own string of shining beads. The man from next door couldn't help but give a sideways grin at the sight of Madame and her finery. And as for herself, she just stood there, coquettishly tilting her head and taking it all as her due. But later, as myself and my daughter held our aching hands to the fire, she remained, looking in through the window, slitting her sides, growing thinner. By morning, she had disappeared like we knew she would, snow being the wrong medium, too slight, too cold to hold her, until all around us, from the grass, the garden wall, the rooftop, the bare trees, the very air, there exhales a kind of glistening. And I'm going to finish with this one. I was at master class in town one day in Killarney, which is just like in the centre of the town, and you know, they're all stands and selling jewellery and all sorts of things going on there. And there was a lady sitting there doing, she was, you know, doing sketches to do her portrait, and she was talking to the woman who was beside her, and they obviously were old friends that had met in a while, and he wanted to her, you know, are you still living up wherever? And she said, no, she said, and she pointed across and she said, I live with a balloon man. And I thought, God, that's a great phrase, and it stuck in my head, phrases, you know. And so this poem came out just some months later out of that, because I thought I was thinking how it'd be like to live with a blue man. I saw a blue man, oh well. Oh, I didn't realize. Okay, I didn't know that. Okay. I'm dedicating this to the blue man. In the house of the balloon man. She fell in love with the balloon man, and she lived with him in his airy house at the top of the hill. There was snow in winter and thaw in spring. She painted pictures of the years turning, sometimes on his skin, a sprig of ivy at his collarbone, daffodils for his cheeks, bluebells on his eyelids, moths in the pale warm folds of his groin, snowberries and fishes on his thighs. Once she made a palimpsest of his back, wrote words for wishes. That evening, with an outrush of air from his lungs, in a few quick twists, he made her a rabbit with a baby rabbit held inside. Every day it brought her smiles that had floated above her on her walks across the hills. She taught it the names of butterflies, how to know the colors of a bird by its song. Every night she lay with the balloon man. She gave him kisses. He whispered stories to her, even while she slept. And the walls of the house breathed out, breathed in to the rhythm they lent it. The roof danced a little, and the chimney let out sudden puffs of laughter. Morning, he released balloons from every window. Into each one he exhaled names for a son, names for a daughter. So that when she woke, the sky was filled with rainbows. Soon she grew round as the hills, round as his hug, round and nippled as the balloons he flew from every tree. One morning, everything burst open on the hills, and the balloon man colored the whole sky pink in welcome. The people of the valleys looked up in wonder at the sky, recalled the woman who fell in love with the balloon man and years before had climbed the hill to live with him in his area house, where the walls breathe out, breathe in, and the roof dances. Thank you very much.